ओम अज्ञानतिमिरान्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपकदा मह्यं ददाति स्वपदान्तिकं वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरुः श्रीयुतपदकमलं श्रीगुरून् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजातं सहकण्डरघुनाथान्वितं तं सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनसहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधाकृष्णपादां सहगणललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितांश्च। नमो विष्णुपादाय कृष्णप्रेष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्तस्वामिन्निति नामिने। नमस्ते सारस्वते देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्यदेशतारिणे वांछाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्य एव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद। हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम 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 हरे हरे। हरे कृष्ण I was asked this evening to speak on the topic of life balancing. How should we lead a balanced life? A very important topic, because without balance there is so much disturbance in life. The whole universe, the whole creation depends on balance. If the earth was a little further away from the sun, we would have got frozen. If we were a little closer to the sun, we would have got burnt. So minute difference can create a big difference. Similarly, levels of the oceans rising just by a wee bit can create so much damage. The whole creation is in a state of balance. Whether it's the cosmic scale, the atomic scale, or the ordinary individual scale. For those of you who are students of science, you know that there is an atom and there is an atomic structure which scientists talk about, nucleus and electrons and protons and so on. And everything is going on in a state of complete balance. It's a dynamic balance. If things were to change even a little bit, then the atomic structure would change. The atom wouldn't be what it is. If you knock out an electron, then there's so many consequences to it. Similarly, in the whole universe, everything is done according to balance. Everything is as if fine-tuned to balance. Just as when we tune our radio sets or television sets, we are tuning the volume and everything, we fine-tune it. So it appears that the whole universe is fine-tuned. When I speak to university students and I'm dealing with skeptics, especially those who study science, and because of science they somehow come to a conclusion that it's illogical or irrational to believe in God, I say, please see, please look at the way the laws of nature, the laws of science have been framed. How is it that everything is so harmonious and balanced in the entire creation that you can make precise laws out of them? When you study the way the universe is designed, you will see that everything is so precise. down to mathematical details, you can identify or understand the way this creation works. It's as if everything is fine-tuned. Someone is there to balance, turn the knobs, to see that there's just enough heat, just enough light, just enough oxygen, just enough of whatever it takes for things to be the way they are. Such precision cannot happen by chance. Precision and harmony means that there is someone behind the scene who is manipulating something, who is controlling something. And things don't happen on their own. You need to calibrate things, but also things tend to go off track on their own. Let me illustrate the concept of balance in our life by comparing it to driving a car. So this is going to be a very interesting analogy. So consider that living your life is like driving a car. I don't know how many of you have driven a car in India, but if you can drive one there, you can drive one anywhere. Even in the sea or in the mountains, you can drive anywhere. But things here are more disciplined. So everyone follows rules. Everyone signals left and right before they move, switch lanes, or they turn left and right, and so on. But here, even here in Australia, a driver has to be very careful, very cautious. The car always has to be in balance. And that balance is always a dynamic balance. A dynamic balance means it's a balance, number one, that is maintained in motion, in a state of motion. That's the first implication of the word dynamic balance. And the second implication of this term, dynamic balance, is that you have to keep it in balance by continued effort. Even if it's an automatic car, you just start the ignition and sit back. But still, you have to negotiate unexpected things or even expected things. There's a signal. Someone suddenly turns to the right in front of you. So you have to negotiate, navigate. You have to navigate and make changes accordingly and maintain the balance of your car. So dynamic balance means that you're maintaining the car very stable. It's moving at just the right speed so that you are comfortable. And the car doesn't get into any accidents. There's no inconvenience to anyone. And then you move around. That's called a state of dynamic balance. Now I'll ask you one question. When you're driving a car, what are the important things you need to keep in mind? What are the factors that anyone has to keep in mind when they're driving a car? Let's have a few answers from you. You can raise a hand. Yes.
Hazards.
Hazards. What sort of hazards? People running across the street without a proper signal, all right. Anything else?
Fuel.
Fuel. You should have fuel, all right. Be conscious. That means don't be asleep, you mean?
Yes.
All right. I see the signboards here in Australia, sleep kills or fatigue kills or something like that. They're always warnings that you should not be too fatigued. Better pull up on the side and then take some rest and then drive on. What else? What are the other factors that any one of you would consider when you sit in a car to drive? Yes.
Maintaining the car on time,
okay.
Knowledge to drive the car.
We presume you have that because you got a license, yes?
We need to have a front view mirror and a rear view mirror, which is very important, and also the accelerator with
okay.
The
brakes. Okay, you got to have the mirrors, rear view mirror, side view, the accelerator and the clutch, yes?
Speed of lights.
The speed. Okay, all right, speed limits, and otherwise there's double demerits and merit. Yes?
Brakes.
Brakes, okay.
License,
all right.
Balance the car, the steering.
Balance the car and the steering, okay.
Knowledge of the rules
and the roads. Excellent. Everything all of you have said is right, but you haven't said the most important thing. Yes? Absolutely. You should get a prize. Please note, what is your name? Sorry?
Shailaja.
Shailaja. Okay, so Shailaja gets a prize. Please remember. The most important thing you have to keep in mind when you sit in a car is, where do I want to go? Do you sit in a car for no reason at all? I'm sure we all have better things to do. We have a home. We could sit in our home and do nothing if we liked. So when you sit in a car, assuming everything else that you said today is perfect, but if this one thing is not taken care of, then where do you stand? Imagine a person driving a car. This driver is an excellent driver. The car is in excellent condition, properly serviced, all the mirrors in order, brakes, clutch, everything in order, fuel in order, well serviced. You know all the rules and regulations. You can recite the rules of the Australian Traffic Authority by heart, verbatim, word to word. You know everything about the roads and which turn to take where, but you don't know where you want to go. You're driving, you're following all the rules and regulations. You never break a rule. You're the perfect driver, you're the role model for the Australian Traffic Authority. They'll use you as a role model. This is how you must drive the car. But you don't know where you're going. You drive and drive and drive all around Melbourne, following all the rules perfectly. But you don't know why, and you don't know where. So you're maintaining the dynamic balance. You're an expert driver. You know how to control the car, how to move it between other cars, and turn left and turn right and speed up and slow down. But you don't know the destination. So what would you say about such a driver? Is there something there? Something that's unusual?
Automatic.
But if there's someone and you ask them, where are you going? You're sitting in a car and driving, and you ask this gentleman, say, my dear sir, where are you going? So I don't know. Now, you'll think about him, isn't it? You'll think maybe he needs some attention. Now, if there's someone who claims he doesn't know where he's going, but he's going very fast, he's going beautifully, then there's something missing there in that person's life. So people in this world today are very busy going nowhere in their life. Very busy traveling, but getting nowhere. For the simple reason, they don't know where they are going. They don't know where they're coming from. They don't know where they're going. They don't even know why they have to move on and on. They just move and move and move. So Srila Prabhupada used to say, what is the difference between humans and animals? The Vedic scriptures speak about 4 points that are common between humans and animals. Ahara nidra bhaya maithunam cha samanya maitat pashupi naranam. Dharmo hite shamadiko visheshu dharme nahina pashubhi samana. So the meaning is that there are 4 things that are common to animals as well as humans: eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. But still we know that there's something special about humans. No. What's special about humans is not that they drive a car and animals can't drive cars. That's not what's special. Because Srila Prabhupada says that what's the difference? If eating, sleeping, mating and defending is all that we as humans are doing, then there is no difference between us and the animals. The animal runs on four legs and we run on four wheels. But we are still running for the same purpose, eating, sleeping, mating and defending. All we are doing is to do these things in a more sophisticated and polished way. That's all. But essentially we are doing the same thing. Even if we are successful in colonizing the moon or colonizing Mars, nowadays there's talks of one-way tickets to Mars, so you can go there and colonize the Mars, as if we haven't created enough problems on one planet that we want to go and ruin other planets also. We've spoiled one planet. We have killed each other, destroyed the planet, made life miserable for everybody else, including ourselves also. And we want to go and spoil other planets. Why? Eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Prabhupada says, even if you do go to these planets, what are you going to do that's different from what you're doing here? You're going to do the same eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Just in a different way, that's all. So really, doing these four activities in a more sophisticated way isn't a sign of civilization. It isn't a sign necessarily of advanced intelligence even. Unless that one extra special feature is taken very seriously by the human being. The human being is not considered to be a human according to the Vedic standard of civilized life. Dharmo hi tesham adhiko vishesho. There is one thing that the human being has which the animal doesn't, and that is spirituality. A sense of purpose in life. A sense of understanding where he or she is going in life. Where he or she ought to go. The intelligence to inquire about that. And then the determination to adopt the means to achieve that goal. Dharmena hina pashubhi samanaha. And without this, the human is no better than an animal. So therefore, understanding of the goal of life, the purpose of life, is the first and most important thing before we discuss any idea of balance. Because when you talk of balance, you have, what are you balancing all this for? What is the purpose of this balance? Or is it just a purposeless, meaningless balance? There are some philosophers, including many scientists today, who say that the universe has no purpose. It's just a meaningless existence of some atoms and molecules. That you and I are also merely combinations of some chemicals, that's all. They reduce everything down to just neurochemical impulses in the brain. So all the emotions that we experience, love, greed, hate, anger, they reduce everything down to just some signals in the brain. Even pain is like some particular nerve firing somewhere. So this kind of philosophy, where we try to reduce everything down to just the workings of matter, the workings of atoms and molecules and chemicals, this is called reductionism, where you reduce everything down to just matter and you divest this universe and living entities of any spirituality, of anything beyond matter. And you say that life is simply a combination of matter. Life is merely chemicals and atoms and molecules. So therefore they say that this whole creation has happened by chance. And because it's happened by chance on its own accord, therefore there's no purpose to it. So it's meaningless, it's pointless. But now that we are here, what do we do? How do we make sense of this world? So this kind of philosophy is also very popular nowadays. But we understand by basic logic that nothing happens by chance. Everything happens because of a cause. There is cause and effect. There is action and reaction. So if the universe is the way it is today, it's because of something that happened in the past. And actions are always done by intelligent entities. Actions don't happen of their own accord without any intelligent cause. So we understand now that there must be some purpose. Even very, very intelligent philosophers and scientists can get bewildered. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna refers to these people as Mayaya Paharita Jnana. Jnana means knowledge, Maya means illusion, Apaharita means that which is taken away. So even though these philosophers and so on are very intelligent from a material point of view, some of them may be even in the category of what we call geniuses. They may be parts of members of the Mensa Club, where the IQ is phenomenally high. Brilliant people, undoubtedly. But Mayaya Paharita Jnana, which means that knowledge is stolen by illusion. They use their good intelligence to arrive at some atheistic or godless conception of the universe and of life. And therefore everything becomes a big zero. Everything becomes pointless. But life is not like that. Life is important because it has a purpose. Everything has a purpose. This mic has a purpose. This table has a purpose. And to use things for the purpose for which they are intended is real spirituality. A very strange definition of spirituality, you might think. To use things for the purpose for which they are intended. And first we have to understand who we are. We are spiritual beings, so what is our purpose? We are expected to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, because that is our constitutional position. That is what we are meant to be. So when we serve the Supreme Lord Krishna, then we become happy. That is the very purpose of our life. And then Krishna takes us back to his abode, the spiritual world, which is far beyond this universe. Try telling anyone in the spiritual world that there is no purpose for existence. It doesn't make sense to them, because they've already reached the perfection of that purpose. They're with Krishna, enjoying pastimes in the spiritual world with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So life has a purpose. That purpose of life is pure love of God. To achieve that love, that happiness that we have always been hankering for. So once we have that in mind, we keep this purpose in mind, then comes the question of fine-tuning the balance. Otherwise, balance has no meaning, devoid of a purpose. Just like the man driving the car, perfectly, but not knowing where he's going. So once the purpose is clear, that this is the goal of my life, this is what I want to do, then we can decide how the balance has to work. Usually when you talk of balance, what do you need to do? What do you need to set? I'm looking for one word. What do you need to set when you're looking for a balance?
Parameters.
Time. Yes, who set that? Priorities? Yes, another gift. Priorities. When you want to balance something, you have to set priorities. How do you set priorities? What is your number one priority? That which is most important to you is your number one priority. What is next is your next priority. So we prioritize things in our life depending on how important we consider those things to be in our life. Many times when devotees or people take to spirituality very seriously and they spend quality time for spirituality and it causes a drastic change in their life, they give up certain habits and practices, they adopt new practices and habits, their company changes, their whole lifestyle changes, their attitudes, their thinking, their very purpose changes. And seeing such a drastic change, acquaintances many times may say, well, you know, you're doing too much. Don't you think you're doing too much of this? Don't you think you should be balanced? Because for them, spirituality is not a priority. Why is it not a priority? Because they don't think it's important enough. Because they think spirituality is just one part of life. It's something that I do by the way, just as I'm going to movie and I do this and I do that and I also do my spirituality. I don't remember who it was, but some philosopher who said, we are not human beings with a spiritual experience, but we are spiritual beings with a human experience. In other words, we are spiritual entities who are presently engaged in a human body. And this human body affords the most excellent opportunity for us to revive that innate spirituality in us. So therefore, spirituality is the most important thing in our life because it is the very purpose of our existence. It is the very goal of our life. So naturally, we must give it the highest priority. So people who say, well, you shouldn't give so much importance to it, you must balance it out a little bit, they usually imply that after all, there are other things in life that are also very important. It's because they do not understand the real paramount importance of spirituality that they speak like this, or they object. But when we understand that this Krishna consciousness, this process of developing our innate spirituality to the point of perfection where we develop our love for the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna is reached, and that is the perfection of life, then yes, then we set our priorities differently. Then this becomes the most important thing and everything revolves around that. Then spirituality becomes a central focus and the other departments of our life are adjusted so that it will enhance the attainment of our spiritual objective. Everything else in life revolves around the spirituality. When somebody doesn't understand this one point, that spirituality is the most important aspect of our life, in fact, it is the fundamental reality of our life, even if they're interested in spirituality, for them spirituality will be just another department of life. So they will have their material life, and around their material life they will have so many other departments, which includes spirituality. So then they say, well, you see, you shouldn't give too much importance. After all, it's just one of the things in life that you have to do. So it's a question of vision and understanding of the importance of spirituality. So for those who are aspiring or staunch devotees, pursuing the path of spirituality with great vigor and seriousness, this is the important point. That the focus, the center of our life has to be our Krishna consciousness. Then everything else revolves around that. So for devotees, we generally tend to see how our profession works, how our family is going on, how everything else is, and then according to the time that's available, we fit in the spirituality somewhere. But no. The focus must be on the spirituality, and then everything must be balanced in order to attain that spiritual goal. So spirituality pervades and permeates every aspect of the devotee's life. Even the devotee has many departments in life which need to be balanced. Which are the departments in our life? Can you mention some of them? Simple enough.
Family,
very good.
Work.
Profession or work, yes.
Health,
very good.
Education.
Hmm? Education, profession, okay, as you understand it today, fine, all right.
Finance,
very right.
Responsibilities,
well, that's taken care of in these other things, yes. So more or less, these are the different departments you have in your life. And we need to balance out these different departments. But do you see these departments as being independent departments? Are they independent departments?
No.
They are correlated with each other. But do they also have a root or a foundation? That depends on what you understand the goal of life to be. For some people who have no understanding of the goal of life, or they just think that life is meant for enjoyment, then that is their pivotal point. They will do everything in order to enjoy the sense gratification and pleasures of this world. But devotees will adjust everything in their life to attain Krishna consciousness. That's the difference. Even those who are not spiritual try to balance their lives, but their goal is different. Nowadays, yoga is becoming very popular all over the world. And I was in America and I saw a proliferation of these yoga schools. And many of them do yoga, all of them actually, do yoga for good health. And good health for what? Enjoyment. That's the bottom line. Because we want to enjoy this material world, so we need good health. Because we want to enjoy this material world, we need good money. Because we want to enjoy this material world, we need a good education and a good profession so we can get a lot of money to enjoy. So everything is based upon this one idea that we want to enjoy this world. However, that is a recipe for misery according to the Bhagavad Gita. According to Bhagavad Gita, the real purpose is to be Krishna conscious. So the same principle, just as those who do not understand the goal of life and think that enjoyment is the goal, just as they try to balance their life in such a way as to attain that goal of enjoyment, we should also balance our life to attain that one goal of Krishna consciousness. So that is our focus. Just as they focus on enjoyment as the goal, we focus on Krishna consciousness as the goal. So why do we maintain good health? So we can serve Lord Krishna better. We can chant our japa, our kirtan better. We can do more service to Krishna. Why do we want to have a job or a profession? So that we can earn money. And what do we do with the money? Go to Hawaii? Or go surfing? So that we need to maintain ourselves and the family. And then we can live comfortably enough to serve Krishna peacefully without being bothered about where our next meal will come from, where we will get shelter, and so on. And we can also use the money for Lord Krishna's service. So a devotee does everything with this one idea in mind. So this is the one factor. Whatever decisions in life we want to take, whether they are big decisions or small decisions, whether you want to decide to take an extra chapati for lunch or not, or whether you want to talk about switching a job or moving place from one city or country to another, or getting married, or whatever it is, the one idea is, the one point that will most importantly define or determine your decision is, how will it impact my Krishna consciousness? In the short term as well as in the long term. So that is the point we have to consider. Then everything will automatically be balanced. Generally we see that when devotees become very enthusiastic about Krishna consciousness, which is a good thing, they tend to sometimes lose that sense of balance with health or with family and so on. Then that causes a disturbance. Now let's come back to the driving example. Now imagine there's the same perfect driver, but now this driver knows where he's going and he's getting there perfectly. So that's the perfect combination. So the driver has to adjust, has to do so many things, negotiate the roads and maintain a perfect balance. So similarly in our life, as we negotiate the ways, turbulent ways of life in this material world, as we approach Krishna, we'll have many obstacles, many unforeseen things happen in our life that may upset our plans. They say, man proposes, God disposes. So we want to lead our life in a certain way and we hope and pray that in 2 years we can become pure devotees. And then something comes along and upsets the apple cart. And things don't work out as smoothly as I anticipated. So we have to keep negotiating and navigating the turbulent paths of this world. So that calls for dynamic balance. We always have to set the balance right. Now just come back to the driving of the car. Now how acute is the importance of balance? You have lanes in the road. Imagine if the driver is a little inattentive and just by a couple of feet shifts the car to the next lane, the other car is coming here, there would be an accident. There can be a calamity if the fine balance is lost. Or perhaps the driver nods off for a moment. I know of several devotees who have had car accidents like this. Because they just nodded off to sleep for a moment. And in that moment, they just banged into, because they were traveling at a reasonably high speed, they banged into a lamppost or they banged into the wall or went off the road somewhere. So one has to be very attentive to see that one doesn't cross the line. And even if one does, then one comes back very quickly. Similarly, let us say that as devotees today, there is a festival and we are giving all our time and energy we're spending, we are up there late night, we hardly had any sleep, we are decorating the temple, we are doing so many services, we haven't had sleep, and perhaps we haven't had time to eat much even. But then, can that balance be maintained if we continue like that? No. So the next day we have to make sure we catch up on sleep. We make sure we eat properly so the balance is restored. So it's like going like this and you always move a little from the main line. But you... Yes. As the balance sometimes is disturbed. This also happens because of balance. Pressure. Pressure from inside, pressure from outside. If we don't maintain the balance, that's what can happen to our life. An explosion. So when you're driving the steer, you're holding the steering wheel, you're always controlling it. The car may go a little this way, a little this way and that way, but you go you're very particular to keep it going straight. And even if there are little variations, you keep coming back. Sometimes you have to overtake a car which is going slow, you go to the left, but then you come back. From the fast lane, you come back to the middle lane, and then you have to take the exit, so then you move in this lane. So you're constantly moving, but you're moving with an eye on your destination. That's how you maintain the balance. So similarly, we fasted yesterday, we didn't have sleep, but now we have to catch up. We moved a little this way from the health department side. Spiritual department was very good. We did a lot of service. We chanted a lot. We heard a lot. We served a lot. But the health department suffered. Family department suffered because I was doing so much service in the temple, I neglected the family. I took a few days leave from work. But now I have to get back to work. I have to give time to the family. I have to give time to my health. So we come back this way now. Over a short period of time, recoup whatever deficiency there was in these other departments, but not for long. And then come back again. And sometimes there may be another little change, and we go on like this, always keeping in mind the goal as Krishna. So we keep making these little changes, left and right, we move on. So the dynamic balance means that we must be ever attentive and vigilant to see that the balance is maintained over a reasonable span of time. Many times devotees ask, how much should we read Srila Prabhupada's books? Srila Prabhupada said every day. But for some reason, if you are unable to read every day because of certain reasons, alright, you couldn't read for a day, you couldn't read for 2 days, maybe 3 days, alright, but then after that make sure you read. You went off balance, but don't remain off balance for long in the reading department. Come back soon to normal. Even if it means you cut down on some other department. And the other department which you've cut down on, you can restore the balance with time, and then you go on like that. That's how the dynamic balance of life will work. Are you following what I'm saying? So it's a question of being vigilant all the time and navigating so that you can juggle with all these things. Imagine a juggler throwing up so many balls at the same time, making sure none of them fall. That's what life is all about. Family, health, money, sadhana, seva, going up and down. That's the balance we have to do. So you have to be an expert juggler. So you have to be attentive. And everything depends on how you prioritize things. One time there was a school teacher who did an experiment for the students. He said, okay, I have on the table in front of me, he told the children, one big glass jar, very big. And here I have some sand. Here I have some water. Here I have pebbles of different sizes. These are bigger stones. These are smaller stones. Those are smaller pebbles. And those are fine, that's fine gravel over there. Now I want you to put all of these things in this one big glass jar. So one student came up. And then that student took the water, filled the jar, then took the sand, put it in the water, then took some of the pebbles, put it there. There was no place left now to put the bigger stones and the other things. So it was unsuccessful. So the teacher asked another student. The other student also tried various combinations but was not successful. Many students tried it this way. Then the teacher said, okay, now I'll do it for you. What would you do if you were to fill it? What would be the sequence? Yes.
First we need to fill the big stones, which are the first priority.
The first thing you have to put in the jar are the big stones. Okay, and then?
Then after that, the spaces between the big stones should be filled with the pebbles.
Okay, the smaller stones should go in there, and then the pebbles will come in. The space is filled in between the ears.
Then the very intra spaces are filled with the sand. And
then okay, then the intermediate spaces are filled with sand. Then? And then with water. I think you deserve another prize. So we have quite a few prize winners this evening. Excellent. What do the stones represent, the big stones? The first priority in life. What does the water represent? No. Water represents the other things in life that may be of a lower priority. They're important, we do them in life, but not so important. So we fit in the big stones. In other words, what is the most important thing in our life? We take care of that. Our spiritual activities, our sadhana, our chanting, and such things, we do that first. Settle that. Then there's other things to do. And we prioritize it in such a way that gradually everything that we need to do in our day or in the week can be accomplished by this principle. Then you will see that things will become much easier to manage. Sometimes when devotees ask me, how should we balance? I come to a very simple answer in my mind. Do things when they are supposed to be done, to the degree they are supposed to be done, and in the way they are supposed to be done. That's the best answer I could think of. When it's time to chant, chant. When it's time to sleep, sleep. If you interchange the two, when it's time to sleep at 12 o'clock at night, you're chanting your rounds. Or when you're supposed to be chanting, then you're sleeping. So when it's time to eat, eat. When it's time to work, work. When it's time to read, read. So simple, isn't it? We just have to know what to do when and how much. So if we plan our life in such a way that we know what to do, when, and how much, then we have substantially solved the problem of balance. But please know that this problem of balance is not something that strikes only new devotees. Everybody in the universe, even the advanced devotees of the Lord, have to face this challenge. Because time is limited. There's only 24 hours. And there's only so much you can do in 24 hours. You all know the pastime of Krishna being tied to the grinding mortar by his mother, Yashoda. And it all started because Krishna broke the pot of yogurt that was in the room. Mother Yashoda was feeding baby Krishna milk, and all of a sudden she kept Krishna down because she saw the milk was boiling on the stove. The milk was meant for Krishna too, because she wanted to make some nice ghee or some nice butter and some nice sweets and so on. So the milk was also for Krishna, but here she was personally feeding Krishna, and the moment she saw the milk overflowing, she immediately put Krishna down and rushed to the stove to take the milk off the stove. Meanwhile, Krishna was annoyed. I'm still hungry. And my mother just, without even my permission or saying, can I put you down? Are you okay? She simply just put me down and just ran away to deal with whatever she had to deal with. So Krishna was upset. He was angry. So he broke the pot of yogurt and fled from the scene. And then, of course, you know, Mother Yashoda came back and saw the whole spectacle and understood it was Krishna's doing. She chased him, caught him, tied him to the grinding mortar. And that's the celebrated Damodar Leela, the pastime. But in this connection, when Mother Yashoda leaves, or rather puts Krishna down, and goes to attend to the stove, Srila Prabhupada comments that in a devotee's life, there will often be situations, I am paraphrasing it, there will often be situations when devotees are confronted with many services to do at the same time. So even if you talk about Krishna consciousness itself, what to speak of the other departments like health and family and profession and so on, even within this sphere of Krishna conscious activity, at one time there are so many options open to us. To chant, to read, to go to the temple and do some service, etc. So Srila Prabhupada says, devotees are often confronted with the dilemma or opportunity of doing more than one devotional service at one time, and they have to make a choice that they have to do this service and not that service at that particular point in time. And how can they make that choice? Srila Prabhupada quotes a verse from the Bhagavad Gita. Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upayantite. The meaning of this verse is that for those who are constantly devoted to me and serve me with love, with faith, I give them the understanding by which they can approach me. In other words, the more Krishna conscious we become, the more Krishna from within will actually guide us. The more we will be able to perceive the Lord's guidance from within. Krishna will give us that intelligence by which to judge how to fine-tune balances in our life, how to prioritize things and fine-tune that balance. In other words, we have to chant our rounds very nicely. We have to read Srila Prabhupada's books and understand the philosophy very well. We have to hear discourses very attentively. We have to offer all kinds of services to the Supreme Lord in the association of devotees, make friendships with devotees, and use our intelligence to balance out the other departments of our life so that they harmonize with our ultimate Krishna conscious objective. So the more we do that, the more naturally Krishna will make our head clearer. With a clear head, we will be able to figure out things better. When we don't chant, we get a muddled head. We're not able to understand what to do. We're always bewildered. But with good chanting, which is a fundamental thing in our life, everything becomes clear. Like sunlight. So these are a few thoughts on how we can try to balance our life. Fundamentally, as I mentioned, it is the chanting of the holy names that is really so important. When we chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, it cleanses unwanted things from our heart, gives us purity of mind, clarity of thought and intelligence, and also it endows us with spiritual potency. It also protects us from unpleasant experiences or protects us from becoming dejected when unpleasant experiences happen. Then we can remain happy even in the midst of the trials and tribulations of this world. So we have to take this process of Krishna consciousness very seriously. Connect ourselves to the community of devotees and follow the process that Srila Prabhupada, our founder Acharya, has outlined based on the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam. Then automatically everything will fall in place. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. So if any of you have any questions, you may please raise your hands. You can ask them from where you are. Or you can also ask for a slip of paper and you can write down your questions and you can send them up too. Or just raise your hand very simply. And yes.
How can one detect the presence of the soul?
Can you speak in the mic, please? Into the mic. Speak into the mic. Hold it close.
How can one detect the presence of the soul?
How can one detect the presence of the soul? Srila Prabhupada answers that by saying, by its symptom. Consciousness. Consciousness is a symptom of the soul. And consciousness means life. So where you see the symptoms of life, you know there is consciousness. And where there is consciousness, you know there is a soul. So it may be a microbe, it may be a tree, it may be a human being, but the soul is present. The simplest answer to your question. Okay? Any other questions? Supreme balance. Yes, there's one question at the back.
Sometimes when you have to, say when you're working too much and you don't get time to come to temple, and then you can't do your services right and you have to bring someone to it. So devotees, they start to think if you're falling back, or even though you're trying your best, you're still chanting, you're still trying to listen to lectures and stuff, but you're not coming to the temple. So how do you do that without offending devotees? Because they think that, you know, you're not doing the right thing.
Okay. Your question is, how do you not offend the devotees by not coming to the temple when you don't come to the temple?
Say, if you're pulling a ship, 12-hour ship, and you practically can't, because you have to do stuff at home as well.
You mean because of some professional reason?
Yeah.
Because you have a night shift or something like that and you can't come? Well, I'm sure devotees will understand. If you explain the reasons for your inability to come at certain programs, everyone is struggling with their own lives, with their own situations, so they will definitely understand if you are in a certain predicament. At the same time, you could also consider coming at other times then. If you can't come at certain times, come at other times. A more extreme solution could be, depending on the circumstances, try to convince your authorities to give you a job or give you a shift that's decent. And an even more extreme solution, I'm not saying you should do it, but it's there, to look for another job. Well, you don't have to stay up all night, and say that you can come to the temple and participate in all the programs. Okay, thank you. Any other question? Today everyone is so quiet, I wonder why. It's very, normally there's always so many questions.
When you say humans are different to animals...
I beg your pardon, can you say that again?
When you say humans are different from animals...
Yes.
When you look at animals like, you know, elephant or thing, and then look after the youngs, and if one dies, it has great feelings, sorrow and all that. How do we know that they do not have same kind of human soul?
You know, they definitely do. They also have a soul, as I said now, that every living being has a soul. What to speak of an elephant, even a bacterium has a soul. A plant has a soul. So yes, they're living beings and they also feel emotions. They have their families. I don't know if they have divorces, but they have families. they have families, they have their children. They experience all the emotions, just like humans do. So therefore, as I said at the beginning of my talk, that performing one's duties in life in terms of family, etc., eating, sleeping, mating, defending, and so on, are not the special prerogative of the human species of life. That is also found in all the animals and even the birds. They are also fiercely protective of their own, offspring, of their own kind. But the special feature of the human being is that the human being can sit and discuss what we are discussing today. We don't find elephants sitting together or bacteria sitting together to have discussions on Bhagavad Gita. It's not possible. But for humans it's possible, and if human beings don't do such things, then they're not considered from the Vedic point of view to be very evolved human beings. Even though they may be considered very famous or very successful human beings, but from the standpoint of modern society. All right? Yes, someone raised a hand somewhere? Yes, please. Can you have the mic, please? Yeah.
I've heard a story that Krishna, when on his Garuda crusade, an elephant, because the elephant was his devotee.
Yes.
So if animals didn't have spirituality, how come that elephant had it? And how come it made Krishna go and save him?
There's your answer. That was a very rare case. A very rare case. But bhakti is such that even animals can become Krishna conscious because it goes, the holy name penetrates to the soul, to the very soul. I usually narrate these incidents in India, in the state of Orissa. At one place there was a Bhagavat Katha. That means a speaker was coming and speaking on the Srimad Bhagavatam, on a holy scripture. And he was doing it for 7 days in succession. Now, every day at the appointed time when the lecture was to begin, there was a bull who would come in. Now imagine if you're sitting here and a bull comes, walks in here, there's going to be chaos here, isn't it? So naturally, the first time the bull came, everyone ran helter-skelter to see what it was all about, and they tried to shoo him away. But you know what they mean when they say bull-headed. So he had made up his mind. He wanted to attend the program. So he sat there comfortably. And when everybody realized that this is what he wanted to do, they were happy. So they all sat along with the bull and they were hearing the lecture. Went on for a couple of hours. This made front page news, headlines in the newspapers, local newspapers. And after the lectures were over, he got up and quietly walked away. Oops, no mobiles here, please. No, that's a no. Double demerits. only to return the next day for the lecture, right at the time when the lecture was to begin. Sat through the whole thing. Got up, walked away. Again, for 7 consecutive days, he came exactly at the time the lecture was to begin, sat down, heard it, and went away. Who knows what he was in the previous life and why he got the body of a bull. But that Krishna consciousness was something was there. He was doing it. I remember in Bombay there was another place There's one devotee who has his car garage, and he converted his car garage into a small temple. And he would organize programs there every Friday evening. And devotees would come and attend a discourse on the Bhagavad Gita. And I remember going there also. This was way back. And in the late 80s, and I think it's still going on. And all through the 90s also it continued. And in the early, late 80s or the early 90s, there used to be this dog. He was a stray dog. You don't find stray dogs in Australia, but in India you find many stray dogs. This stray dog, or at least everyone presumed he was a stray dog because he didn't have a collar. So he would come and be outside, quietly, sitting down quietly, and after the program was over, he would leave, but never before taking the prasadam, because prasadam was distributed at the end. So he would take the prasadam, then leave. One day, the devotee who owned the place, he downed the shutters of the temple hall. Everyone had left, and he was busy taking care of all the visiting devotees, and somehow he forgot about the dog, who was quietly sitting in one corner somewhere in the compound. And then he noticed the dog was still there, because he hadn't got prasad yet. So he got the prasadam, he ate the prasadam and quietly went away. Nobody knew where he came from, who he was. He would come only on Friday evenings at 7 o'clock and leave after the program was over. Nobody knew where he went. But again, next Friday, he was back. And this went on for years. I also remember one time, many years ago, I was in a park in India. I had a long day and I thought, let me just take a little walk and chant some rounds on my beads. So there was a little park nearby and there was a bench. So I sat down on the bench after walking and I was chanting nicely. And this stray dog came along. And you know, in India, when a stray dog comes too close to you, you get a little apprehensive, you see. So I was trying to focus on my chanting, but this dog was coming up really close to me. Then I pulled up my feet and sat so that he wouldn't have to nibble at my feet. So then I pulled up my feet and sat. And then I continued chanting. And he parked himself there, right below. And then he had his ears like this, up. And then I was chanting. And he was sitting there quite at ease. Normally dogs are restless. They're always shuffling and moving and shaking their head or something. But this time this dog was just sitting quietly there. And it seemed to me that he was just simply listening to what I was chanting. And that was probably some of the best chanting I've done in my life. Not out of fear, but because I was so blissful that this dog was getting benefited by some chanting. So now I realize I was chanting not for myself but for this dog. And I chanted and chanted and chanted. I had long finished my rounds, but these were extra rounds. It was getting late. But I kept on chanting because it was so blissful. And this dog was just lapping it up with his ears. He was like this. Then I think finally he got bored and shook his head and walked away. But it must have gone on for a good 45 minutes to an hour, I think. So these are exceptional cases where you have these animals even who may take. So what to speak of Gajendra? The story of Gajendra the elephant is from a previous age. Gajendra was a king in the previous life. He was a devotee, Indradyumna. And he somehow offended a great saint. So he was cursed that may you become an elephant. So he became an elephant. But fortunately, at the very time that he needed help the most, when he was engaged in a battle with a crocodile, then he remembered by the Lord's grace the prayers he used to offer to Lord Krishna. And then he started offering those prayers. And then the Lord came in and rescued him. So if it can work for animals, then why not for humans? It can be very, very powerful for humans as well. Yes, some mic there.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
Maharaj, you mentioned, you know, the last point that the Lord rescued that elephant, right? Rescued from death, I believe. Is that what is the...
Yes, problem? Rescued from death, from physical harm, yes.
When, you know, we say rescued from death, in the Gita, the Lord Himself says that He is also death. He is rescuing the elephant from Himself, or what?
No.
What's the rescue from... Because, like, if he is death as well, and we pray that death does not come, or whatever, you know, when somebody is in trouble or, you know, in a critical situation, we all start praying that, you know, this person recovers, be a devotee or not a devotee, whatever, you know, when we do pray. When he says he is death, are we saying that he should not be Krishna? What is it? I mean, how do you define this?
It's not a question of some deep philosophical point here. It's just the natural instinct of every living entity for self-preservation. When confronted with a threat to our life, we want to protect our life. Because it's a natural instinct of the living entity to live. We are the eternal soul, which is eternal. So when confronted with the prospect of termination of a life, then we instinctively react and we want to protect ourselves. So that is not prohibited, that is quite a natural thing. And one of our acharyas, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, explains that if in a life-threatening situation a devotee prays to Krishna for being saved, then that is not a flaw or a fault on his devotional service. It doesn't make that devotee compromised in his devotional service. He doesn't become a fruitive devotee or a mixed devotee. Because those are emergency, that was an emergency situation. So life-threatening situations, because we want to stay on, even as devotees, we would like to stay on to serve Krishna better for various reasons. Yes, but at the same time a devotee is prepared. If Krishna wants to take me away, then so be it. But we must realize that at the time of Gajendra's battle with the crocodile, he had forgotten about his previous life. He was simply just acting on the platform of defending himself because he was attacked by the crocodile. It's only when the battle had gone on for a long time and when he felt himself to be losing now, that's when in desperation he called out to the Lord for being saved. So yes, Krishna comes as death to his time, that's all right. But that's not the way we are expected to relate to Krishna. Krishna says we should link up with him with love, not by dying. The process for realizing Krishna is to chant his names and to love him. And when we do that, when the time comes, then death will come to us as Krishna. But for the non-devotee, Krishna will come as death. Alright? Alright, one question, one last question here. Can you give the mic, please? Okay, someone else had a question? Yeah, please. Go ahead. Then we'll come back here later.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Okay, what are our responsibilities to the environment? Definitely, it is our responsibility to protect the environment. Why? What is the spiritual logic behind it? What is the Krishna conscious logic behind environmental protection as far as devotees are concerned? Can anyone say?
It is the Krishna's property.
Correct. Who said that?
Yes.
Where? Okay, Krishna's property. So, therefore? Yes, because it's Krishna's property, therefore we take care of it. Let's say I know that there is some object which belongs to you. I know it's your object. Let's say your phone or your spectacles. And then I deal with it very disrespectfully. I brush it off the table so it goes flying on the ground. Who am I disrespecting? Who am I disrespecting? You. Why? Because this belongs to you. If I didn't know that this belonged to you, it's still an offense. But at least it's not something malicious towards you. But having known that this belongs to you, if I do that now, then it's an even more grave offense, right? So as devotees, we understand that this is Krishna's property. This environment is prakriti. Prakriti is energy, it's Krishna's energy. So if I exploit Krishna's energy, Krishna's property, and use it disrespectfully, contaminate it, pollute it, then is it not an offense to Krishna? Yes. So therefore, this is the sublime logic for devotees to also be very responsible about environmental protection. We don't see it only in material terms like other environmental activists do. For them, it's just a matter of the fact that we don't have a planet B. So we have to protect this because it's going to help us. We're going to harm ourselves. But we also have a deeper spiritual reason behind it. That we accept. Those arguments are also valid. But deeper are these spiritual reasons. That we see that nature is also divine. We don't see anything disconnected from Krishna. Therefore, when Krishna says, Daivihi esha gunamai mama maya duratyaya, in the Bhagavad Gita, he says this prakriti is Daivi maya, or it is Daivi prakriti, which means divine nature, divine energy. So when we understand the environment or nature is divine, we must deal with nature in a very respectful way. Right? So therefore we should ensure that we do all that we can to protect. It's very much a part of the Vedic culture actually. In the Vedic culture, environmental protection was never an issue because everybody did it. It's only in the modern times that it's become an issue. Yes? Okay, one question I think here. Yes. Last question.
Hare Krishna. Actually, I had a question about at the time of death, when, if you remember Krishna at that time, or you are begging for, you are basically chanting his name at that time, but during your whole life, you haven't done as much spiritual. We haven't been much spiritually uplifted or much haven't done much spiritual activities as we should have. Is there any chance that that you'll be going back to Godhead, or what is
not much chance? Not much chance. If somebody doesn't study for an exam all year round, occasionally by mistake attends a class in the university and sits for the exam, is there a good chance that he or she will pass the exam? Not so likely. So similarly, death is also an examination. Life is a period of preparation for that examination. And we are supposed to prepare right from the beginning, from childhood. In fact, from the time we are in the mother's womb, our mother should prepare us for it. So therefore, we have a lifetime to prepare for that ultimate moment of death so that we can be Krishna conscious when we leave this world. But anyway, better late than never. So suppose we haven't got the chance to do Krishna consciousness earlier. Whenever we get the opportunity, we should take it very seriously. And by Lord Krishna's mercy, we may yet be able to make our life perfect if we are very staunch in our faith and our practice of Krishna consciousness. The Srimad Bhagavatam speaks about a great king, a saintly king called Khatvanga, who became Krishna conscious in only 1 second. In a few moments, actually. He asked how much time he had to live, and the demigods told him, "You just have 1 moment to live." And in that 1 moment, he just focused his mind on Krishna because he had that inclination and he perfected his life. But these are rare instances. Generally, it takes for long years of dedicated, sincere spiritual practice. Okay, so thank you very much for your kind and patient attention, and thank you very much for coming this evening for this program. Hare Krishna.